Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes. And by Curious.com, with a 10-minute interview followed by daily bite-sized learning recommendations to measure and build people's CQ, or Curious Quotient. Curious.com/the world, where people can learn something new every day.
Personal privacy versus national security, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Apple is publicly resisting a U.S. government order to help break into a suspect's phone. But how would that play out in another country?
In Britain, it's a secret warrant signed by a minister, and Apple would just be compelled to comply and would be gagged from telling anybody that this is going on.
Plus, a drought in southern Brazil leads to greater awareness about the value of water.
You cannot expect simply to open your tap and there is water. Each one of us has a responsibility of saving water.
And a Salvadoran American who supports Marco Rubio in the presidential race, but had to be convinced.
In the beginning, I have to admit, I was kind of hesitant, just the fact that he was Cuban.
Those stories and more today on The World. Thank you for being with us today. We want to start with the ongoing legal tussle between Apple and the FBI. The FBI asked Apple to break into the phone of Syed Rizwan Farooq, one of the perpetrators of the attacks in San Bernardino back in December. But Apple has said no. It says the FBI's order is dangerous, a threat to the privacy of ordinary people. The case has certainly reignited the debate in America between national security and privacy, and that's something many countries across the globe are struggling with, too. Dr. Gus Hossain is Executive Director of Privacy International, a pressure group that campaigns against government intrusions. They're based in Britain. And Dr. Hossain joins me now from London. How would the dispute between Apple and the authorities have played out in Britain, do you think?
It would have played out in secret. That's the biggest controversy about the biggest difference between, say, British practice and American practice. In Britain, there's actually no judicial warrant. There's no court involved in this type of process, which is why we know what's going on in California. In Britain, it's a secret warrant signed by a minister, and Apple would just be compelled to comply and would be gagged from telling anybody that this is going on. At the moment, it's quite controversial because the British government, having been caught out by the Snowden disclosures, that the British equivalent of the NSA had been hacking computers and devices around the world, led to the government having to introduce legislation to actually say the government shall have the power to do hacking. And within that piece of legislation, which is still currently in draft mode, it actually includes a power to compel a company to actually help the government to do the hacking. So it's an attempt to legislate what the FBI is seeking in the Apple case.
So the people, the lawmakers who are pushing that legislation, how do they justify it?
They justify it on the national security grounds, saying that we need to be able to have the powers that we've always had, and that hacking a device is the modern equivalent of breaking down a door and doing a search. The problem is that this is the first time a company can be made complicit within the act of doing a search and seizure. Historically, and generally when it comes to how Google and all the other companies comply, is that if these companies have data, the government can ask for it and the companies can hand it over. This completely transforms that debate by saying the company shall not only just comply, it shall assist in the hacking itself.
And how lively is the debate over this proposed legislation? Because here, I mean, it's completely polarized and really unlikely bedfellows are kind of supporting Apple and other unlikely bedfellows supporting the FBI.
We needed this Apple case because the problem is when we think about national security, when we think about law enforcement, we generally think of wiretapping. We're still caught in the 20th century about how these things are done. And the Apple case was the first case that said it's actually more complicated than that, and that Apple will happily comply with the handing over of data, but it's this additional hacking that's problematic. And so in the United Kingdom and anywhere around the world, actually, the debate has not been sophisticated. We actually haven't gotten around to understanding the implications of allowing governments to hack and allowing governments to order companies to be complicit in hacking.
So, Dr. Hossain, you work for a campaigning group that exists to advocate for privacy. What about the argument that in a case like San Bernardino, we need to know who the killers were contacting and what they said?
That's absolutely fine. And it's important to recognize that the phone in question is just one device of many. And authorities in the United States were able to get access to the telephone data of all phone calls made. They're able to approach Facebook and get all the data that Facebook has. It's not as if they're completely blind. There's a richness of data. It's just the FBI wants to use this case to go after something they've never had before, which is the ability to make a company complicit in the hacking.
Dr. Gus Hossain, Executive Director of Privacy International, speaking with me from London. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's more monitoring going on right over your head. I'm talking about surveillance planes. For years, Russia has flown them over the U.S. with our permission. It's part of something called the Treaty on Open Skies, and it's been around since the end of the Cold War. The whole idea of the treaty is to enhance military transparency and cooperation among more than 30 nations. But now, Russia wants to use more powerful cameras in the planes. The New York Times' Eric Schmidt is on the line to help me understand this. So more powerful cameras, what does Russia want to do with them? What do they want to see?
Well, there are two things going on here, according to some U.S. military and intelligence officials. One is the Russians, along with other signatories to this treaty, are switching over from the traditional wet film approach, you think of Gary Powers era type photographs, to digital cameras.
Right, Bridge of Spies and all that.
Yeah, it'll be a more reliable and a faster way of processing these things. The other thing, though, that has some American officials concerned is the routes that the Russians are actually flying when they come to the U.S. They fly about 5 or 6 of these flights a year. And they traditionally have flown over military bases, missile silos, which were fine. But what U.S. intelligence officials say is that the Russians have kind of developed a wandering eye, if you will, and are now also taking pictures of certain critical infrastructure like power plants and weapons test facilities. Some generals fear could be mapping for a possible Russian attack if it ever came to that.
So this Open Skies Treaty, what's the origin of it? I know it's a Cold War, and that's a time of great mistrust between the U.S. and Russia. It allowed us to spy on Russia and vice versa?
Yeah, what it was a treaty initially signed in 1992. It went into effect about 10 years later, and it has 34 different countries are involved, and it basically allows the countries, and many of which are in Europe, to fly flights, surveillance flights, authorized surveillance flights over other signatories' territory. But this is all meant to be kind of enhanced transparency at the end of the Cold War, and reduce the risk of miscalculation that could lead to conflicts.
So is Washington going to allow Russia to improve the cameras they use to monitor us?
Well, it looks like that so far. I think from talking to officials, this is actually a request that's put into the international body that oversees this treaty in Vienna. And the Russians already got approval to use these cameras on smaller planes that they fly in Europe. So now the question is, do they get to use these cameras on longer-range planes? And again, the State Department and some elements of the White House not wanting to add to the already tense relationship the U.S. and the Russians have.
And what do you think, Eric? I mean, in a time, as you say, when the U.S. and Russia are already at loggerheads over Syria and Ukraine, will this lead to greater transparency or just more suspicion?
Well, I think at this point, the U.S. doesn't get a whole lot out of it from an intelligence standpoint. The U.S. has, of course, its whole constellation of spy satellites that provide much sharper imagery than these planes can do. The Russians, on the other hand, they don't have nearly the spy satellite network the U.S. has, and so they rely on these flights over the U.S. to kind of fill in some of their gaps, their intelligence gaps. Many of the Pentagon officials I talked to, and certainly at the State Department, say, oh, these are relatively minor things. We can live with this. There'll be further technological advances down the road that the U.S. may have more concerns about. So I think for now, this is probably going to go forward. There's a 120-day waiting period right now. It's actually a review period. So these flights won't happen anytime, before this summer, in which case there may be time for both sides to kind of work out some test flights to kind of see exactly what these cameras will be taking pictures of.
The New York Times' Eric Schmidt, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Officially, West Africa's deadly Ebola outbreak is over. Last month, the World Health Organization declared Liberia the last of the countries affected Ebola-free. But being Ebola-free and being free of the lingering effects of Ebola are two completely different things. An estimated 11,000 people died during the 17-month epidemic. Thousands of others survived but are still dealing with the disease. Sherry Fink writes about health, medicine, and science for the New York Times. She's won a Pulitzer for reporting on the Ebola epidemic. So there was news today about the Scottish nurse, Sherry. Her name's Pauline Cafferkey, who contracted Ebola while helping out during the epidemic in Sierra Leone. She's back in the hospital, and I believe this is her third hospitalization since theoretically recovering from Ebola and returning to work. Tell us what her Ebola-related health issues are.
She's had quite a difficult course after her surviving Ebola. And last time she was in the hospital, she had a terrible meningitis. She was in the intensive care unit. It took a very long time for her to recover. And they found evidence of Ebola in her spinal fluid when they did a spinal tap. That was really surprising that Ebola could, in a sense, have either hung out there for many, many months or come back. We know very few details now about what has caused her to go back into the hospital. The hospitals in the UK tend to hold information pretty tightly, so we don't have a whole lot of details yet.
Now, I gather the National Institutes of Health has released some information this week about its Ebola survivor study. What has it found so far?
In all three countries that had the most cases of Ebola, there have been some studies to look at survivors, what their health problems are, and in some cases to, you know, help intervene. They enrolled about 1,000 Ebola survivors in their study, and then they also enrolled about 1,000 people who were close contacts of those survivors but who had never been treated for Ebola. There were a number of surprising findings. About 13% of the people who the researchers thought didn't have Ebola actually had antibodies, or the sort of parts of the immune system that you see after you fight off an infection, suggesting that they may have actually had Ebola but might not have shown symptoms.
So that would mean kind of like a lower grade of Ebola.
Possibly so. And there is some thought that the range of illness with Ebola is wider than previously thought. You know, we always thought of it as this horrific, deadly, you know, catastrophic illness, but it may be that in some cases there is a milder infection. Another finding was that both the survivors and their close contacts had a high degree of complaints of health issues. Like, you know, more than 60% were complaining of neurological issues, eye issues, musculoskeletal, sort of like, you know, your muscles, your bones. The most striking of all was that a full 10% of those survivors had something called uveitis, which is a very severe eye disorder, which could lead to blindness, versus none of the people who didn't have evidence of Ebola. So that was a real finding, and it really suggested this is something that, you know, obviously you can treat uveitis with steroids. It's fairly simple to treat. But if you don't do it, if you don't provide that follow-up care for Ebola survivors, then people are in danger of losing their sight. And then the other really important finding and very surprising finding was that quite a number of the survivors, even a year or more after being sick, were found to have Ebola, these are the men, in their semen. And not only that, some of the men who had negative semen tests once or twice later had positive tests, suggesting that it's possible they could be shedding the virus intermittently. So that was a new finding and a very potentially important finding.
Does the evidence suggest that a fresh outbreak of Ebola could occur given what they're finding in survivors?
We already know that, yes, this is possible. And if you look at the history of Ebola outbreaks, even prior to this horrific massive outbreak, there is commonly another outbreak within the next 5 years. The scientists, the public health officials are really very aware of this. There have already been what they're calling flare-ups, where there are one or two or three cases that appear to have come from sexual transmission. And so far, they haven't gone any further than just a very, very small clusters. And of course, this highlights the importance of continuing to invest in everything from survivor care to surveillance and building up these health systems in these countries.
Sherry Fink is a medical and science reporter with the New York Times. Her book, 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital, is out now in paperback with an updated epilogue about Ebola. Sherry, good to speak with you again. Thank you.
Thanks. Good to speak with you, too.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The Zika virus is public health enemy number one in Brazil right now. The virus is carried by mosquitoes, and mosquitoes, as you know, love standing water. But here's the thing. Much of Brazil has been experiencing severe drought. It's been especially bad in Brazil's largest city, Sao Paulo. Water-wise, things are slowly returning to normal there, but the legacy of the city's water crisis lives on. as part of our Across Women's Lives coverage in Brazil this week. Hashtag Her Planet. The world's Carolyn Beeler reports from Sao Paulo.
Many of the alleys in Sao Paulo's favelas, or slums, have trash or weeds in them. The things you'd expect in alleys. But this one in Sao Mateus has something you might not expect. Two brightly painted plastic rain barrels.
Aqui. Água desce lá de
Local resident Teresina da Silva points upward from one of the barrels at the pipe where water gets funneled down from the roof above. It passes through a filter to catch mosquitoes or leaves before collecting in the barrel. Da Silva has three of these water barrels in her own home nearby. We collect water to water plants, to clean the backyard, to do all our house cleaning, and for the toilets, she tells me while standing in the courtyard of her home. Da Silva installed her own rain barrels, but she didn't stop in her own home. She's been teaching other women in her community how to build rain barrels, too. And now there are about 50 of them in the area. We started this project in 2010, she says, when there was already a crisis, though not as bad as now. Now is the tail end of the worst drought on record in the Sao Paulo area. 2 years when reservoirs hit dangerous lows and water shortages brought conflict and health problems to a metropolitan area of 20 million. People were angry. They felt their government wasn't doing enough to solve the crisis. So Da Silva and others started taking matters into their own hands. She's been doing some of this work through a women's collective she helped found called Bread and Art.
E hoje a gente trabalha economia solidária.
We're working together in economic solidarity, sustainability, women's rights, and participation by women, she says. Da Silva's first name means Little Teresa. She's tiny, just 4.5 feet tall, but she's a force in her neighborhood. And she had personal reasons for wanting to help other women tackle the water crisis.
E esse trabalho... Eu, Teresinha, faço com
I do this work
carinho,
with great affection, she says, because I was also rescued. There was a salvation in my life. Da Silva started working as a maid when she was 14 and continued for 30 years. Her life, she says, was work, 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 work. Then in her mid-40s, she started volunteering with a nonprofit that focuses on the welfare of favela residents. She learned that even though she's poor and a woman in a male-dominated society, she could change her future. When you start to discover your rights, you want to fight. You go in search of your dignity, she says. And that's especially true for women, because women, we know this from statistics and because we've lived it, there is a lot of violence against women. Da Silva now works full-time with that nonprofit she once volunteered for, and she's sprouted a new project rooted in the water crisis and local empowerment, Vertical Community Gardens.
Cebolinha.
Da Silva points to some chives she's growing in her courtyard, basil,
manjericão,
and peppers.
Pimenta.
Many of her vegetables grow in plastic water pipes, cut in half lengthwise and hung on the wall. Her goal with the community gardens is to get neighbors working together and to put fresh vegetables on their plates.
Essa é a casa da Maria.
One woman Da Silva is helping build a vertical garden for is Maria Auxiliadora. The garden's being set up on her roof. Teresina is a really important person, Auxiliadora says. She's a very tough person. Even if she's sick or has other problems, she just comes and does work for the community. Da Silva says that work saved her. Likewise, she thinks the drought in Sao Paulo may actually have done a little something to save the environment.
Uma coisa que foi boa essa crise.
A good thing came out of that crisis, Da Silva says. Awareness. The water crisis came at a time when we needed awareness. An awareness that in a country with an eighth of the world's fresh water supply, water still shouldn't be taken for granted.
That was the world's Carolyn Beeler reporting from Sao Paulo. And Carolyn's going to stick with us here for a minute more. Let's talk a bit more, Carolyn, about that terrible drought. That's the backdrop for your story we just heard about Terenzinha Da Silva. I gather she's not the only one who thinks something good came from that drought.
That's right, Marco. So while I was reporting this story, I also talked to Monica Porto, who's the Deputy Secretary of Water Resources for the state of Sao Paulo. And she also said that there were a couple of upsides to this drought. Here's what she said.
One of them was the population learned that water supply is a very important thing, You cannot expect simply to open your tap and there is water. Each one of us has a responsibility of saving water.
Now, of course, the picture is more complicated than that because a lot of poor residents in Sao Paulo actually have never been able to turn on the tap and expect water to come out, like Porto said. So they probably didn't need to learn that lesson.
So I have to wonder if it's the government itself that's really learning this lesson as much as anyone.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, Brazil has historically been a really wet country, so water has never really been treated as a scarce resource there. But that could be changing because climate change is expected to change weather patterns. So Monica Porto also told me that the second upside of the drought is that leaders have realized that the city needs a more robust water system that's better prepared for whatever the future does bring.
We don't know if the São Paulo region will be a region where there will be more floods or more droughts. We know one thing for sure. We have to increase preparedness.
Well, maybe the moral of the story is an ounce of prevention is worth a gallon of cure. The world's Carolyn Beeler, along with the thoughts of Monica Porto from Sao Paulo's Water Resources Department. Carolyn, thanks a lot. Looking forward to hearing more of your reports tomorrow.
Thanks, Marco.
Later in the show, Carolyn has another story about water, but in a different form. She'll tell us about a sculptor who makes art from ice. You wonder how that works in sunny Brazil? Yeah, me too, so stick around. Water's also been on the mind of our friend Deepak Singh. He grew up in the Indian city of Lucknow, and he knows something about cold water, especially showering in it. Deepak now lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, but he recently went home for a visit.
On my recent trip to India, I relived the old days by bathing in cold water. I was staying with my parents, and they have a small water heater that holds just enough water for a quick shower. But one day it broke, so I decided to use the cold tap water. Why not? I thought. This is what I did every single day when I was growing up in India. I always took cold showers. It was difficult until I poured the first mug of freezing water over my head. After a quick shiver, it wasn't too bad. But when I moved here, I learned that showering wasn't something you did in a hurry. You could relax as the warm water fell on your head. I've gotten used to the idea of enjoying a shower, especially in the winter. So when I poured a freezing mug of water over my head back in India, I wasn't prepared. I'd forgotten the art of showering with cold water. The first touch of icy water made me shriek. My parents yelled through the door to ask if I was okay. I heard them, but I couldn't get my voice out. I began to lather up, but my hands wouldn't move fast enough. I took a deep breath and somehow managed to rinse off. When I got out and got dressed, I swore to myself I'd never do it again. It's official. I've gone soft, but so has everyone else in my family. They all shower with hot water in winter, even when it's not so cold.
That's writer Deepak Singh, who takes his long hot showers at his home in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. A year ago, six Guantanamo detainees got a big surprise.
Suddenly they're shackled, put on a plane, and then they arrive in the middle of the night in Montevideo Airport, and the next thing they know, they are free men in Uruguay.
Uruguay, a place they had barely even heard of. Find out how those detainees are faring now, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Imagine you're one of those Guantanamo detainees President Obama was referring to yesterday when he announced the plan to close the detention center before he leaves office. You're released from the prison and then sent to a country you've never visited. You don't even speak the language, but you're so happy to be free that you take off your orange jumpsuit and fly it out the window of your new home like a flag. This actually happened about a year ago with a detainee sent to Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay, which made us ask, why are Guantanamo detainees going to Uruguay? Will Carlos is with our Global Post team. He covers Latin America. There have been some odd parts of the world, Will, that have taken in released Guantanamo prisoners, but apparently Uruguay's taken in a disproportionate number. What is going on there?
So little Uruguay decided about just over a year ago to take in six Guantanamo prisoners or former Guantanamo prisoners. It was big news. I mean, Uruguay is a tiny country, basically no Muslim population really to speak of. I don't recall ever seeing a mosque in Uruguay, and I lived in the capital, Montevideo, for 2 years. And yeah, this was huge news, and it happened actually right in the middle of the election cycle too. So it was very closely watched, and has been pretty closely watched ever since to see how these men have gotten on.
Jose Mujica, the leftist president of Uruguay, he was the one who essentially made this deal, I suppose, with the government in Washington. What was his motivation?
So there's a sort of a cold, skeptical, journalistic way of looking at this, which is to say that these countries basically make these deals to get a quid pro quo, to get something out of the U.S. government. And I think that's been true of many countries that have offered to take detainees in the past. When it comes to Uruguay, you've got a very interesting situation. Pepe Mujica was himself a political prisoner for 14 years, and he very much made this a personal campaign. He said that he wanted to get these men out, and I believe him. I mean, I believe that tack, and if you look at actually how this has unfolded, it's been pretty politically bruising for both Mujica himself and for his party. It's hard to see what Uruguay has kind of gotten in return for accepting these men. I guess that's a way to put it.
How much did these detainees know about Uruguay before they went there?
It's pretty clear that they knew pretty much next to nothing. I mean, there's a wonderful story that was just published in the Islamic Monthly by a friend of mine here in Rio, actually, Taylor Barnes. And it goes into a lot of the details. And some of the interesting details that she dug out was that the lawyers actually printed out sort of a New York Times article. You know, those articles 36 hours in a city. They had an article, right? 36 hours in Montevideo. And one of the attorneys printed that out and gave it to them. So, I mean, these are guys who had basically no internet access, very little access to the outside world. Suddenly they're shackled, put on a plane, and then they arrive in the middle of the night in Montevideo Airport, and the next thing they know, they are free men in Uruguay. It was a pretty extraordinary story to kind of watch unfold.
So, Will, let's talk how these men have assimilated in Montevideo, because at first it seemed, at least the leftists anyway, followed President Mojica's cue and supported bringing them into Montevideo. But then all of a sudden, President Mojica turns against these guys. What happened?
Well, that's where this story really becomes sad and tragic, because what basically happened was that President Mujica very personally invites these men in. A few weeks after they arrive, he meets with them and he holds this very controversial press conference / interview where he talks about how they appear to have soft hands. They appear to be of a higher socioeconomic class. And what he really wanted was he wanted workers to come in. He wanted people who would be willing to sort of go out and work the fields. And he had this very romantic, idealist notion of who these men were. Now, these are men who've just spent 13 years in prison. They've been tortured. They've been psychologically. They've gone through a whole lot of problems. Many of them had just gotten off hunger strike and were extremely weak. A couple of them still are suffering the ill effects of that. So you had this really tragic situation where the president sort of welcomes these men in, gives them a few weeks to assimilate. When they don't surprisingly immediately assimilate into his country, he turns around and starts essentially insulting them and saying, what's wrong with you guys? Why can't you go out and get a job?
They even married Uruguayan wives who converted to Islam, but those relationships apparently also suggest that the transition for these former detainees into normal Montevideo life has not been easy. What is their life like today?
Another tragic chapter of this story. So they two of them married and were then both arrested on charges of domestic violence. I believe the charges were dropped against one of them, and I believe both of those marriages have now fallen apart. So I think that's testament to the sort of psychological problems that these men have had, the difficulty that they've had assimilating. I mean, it's difficult enough for refugees, for people moving to vastly different parts of the world. We see a lot of that in the world today with people leaving Syria and places like that. It's difficult enough for everyday folk to do that. So if you add into the mix the fact that you've just spent 13 years essentially in solitary confinement without charges being brought against you, with the immense psychological damage that these men have got, you can just imagine how difficult this transition has been.
Will Carlos with our Global Post team, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Here's another story from Latin America that our Global Post team is covering. Bad news, it seems, for Bolivian President Evo Morales. In a countrywide referendum, voters have narrowly rejected Morales' attempt to change the constitution and run for a fourth term as president. Simeon Tagle's following the story. Simeon, Evo Morales wanted to be president for 20 years. This referendum was defeated narrowly, it seems, but it was defeated. How has President Morales accepted the news?
Well, he has today said that he accepts the results. He's lost the battle, but not the war, as he put it. That's a little bit of movement, perhaps, from what he was saying on Monday and Tuesday, when he was really clinging to the hope that the rural votes, which are the last ones to be counted, because some of them come from very remote places, those rural votes were more likely to favor him. So he was a little reluctant at first, but today he's accepted the result.
Right. So is this a repudiation of Evo Morales, or is it really public support for Bolivia's constitution?
I think it's a bit of both, and I think it's important to underline that Evo Morales is still a popular president in Bolivia, but I think many voters saw this as overreach. He's already been in power for 10 years, which makes him the longest-serving president in Bolivia's history since independence in 1825. The other thing that's important to understand is that I think politically or tactically, this referendum wasn't perhaps the most astute move, because the no camp united people who didn't like Evo Morales for completely contrary reasons. On the one hand, there is a part of the Bolivian population, wealthy, generally white people, especially in the richer part of the region of the country, Santa Cruz, who never really accepted the idea that an indigenous person could be president of Bolivia, even though the country has a majority that is indigenous. Mm. But then at the other end, there are people who've been criticizing Evo Morales for not being indigenous enough as president. And so those two camps came together, along with a lot of other Bolivians, to vote no.
Is it possible to go even a bit further back and find out when and how the sheen of Evo Morales wore off? Is that even worth asking?
Yes, I think so. One of the big issues that has really just emerged in the last few weeks is a huge corruption scandal. Evo Morales, it turns out, he's single, he's a bachelor, but it turns out that a former girlfriend of his, who he dated for a couple of years, and she was 18 when he met her, by the way, she now has a senior job at a Chinese company that's won nearly $600 million of contracts from the Bolivian state. This emerged in the last few weeks, and really has tainted Evo Morales' image within Bolivia. He's previously been accused of tolerating corruption, but not necessarily being corrupt himself. But that perception has perhaps shifted with this revelation.
She was 18. How old was Morales when they met?
He's 56 now, so he would have been 45 or thereabouts at the time.
Yeah, so progressivism is somewhat selective in Mr. Morales.
Yes, you could say that.
Is this another bit of evidence that the so-called pink tide, this trend of leftist-leaning governments in Latin America, is actually ebbing?
Well, it's being interpreted that way. I'm not so sure myself. I think what a lot of voters, citizens in Bolivia, but also in other parts of Latin America, including Argentina and Venezuela, really want is not necessarily a government that is more conservative, but they want a government that is basically a more efficient, more responsive, more transparent government, a better government, whether it's from the left or the right, and one that really pays attention to citizens' wishes. And I think that's part of what we're seeing, certainly in Bolivia.
So what do you think we're going to see from Evo Morales in the next couple of years? Any major shifts in policy?
If he learns the correct lesson, perhaps, from this defeat, he might try to address the concerns within Bolivia that he favors his own Aymara indigenous group over some of the other many indigenous groups in Bolivia. The international perception of Evo Morales is as this champion of indigenous rights. But within Bolivia, there's been a lot of conflict and tension within the different groups, particularly with the Aymara who are in the highlands and groups who live in the Amazon. For example, Evo Morales has tried to push a freeway through the Amazon that has really provoked a lot of opposition. So he may want to consider addressing that.
Simeon Tagle with our partners at Global Post. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Street harassment is something women across the world have to deal with, and Kosovo is no exception. But a group of young women there are fighting back using their computer programming skills. They're building a smartphone app to report harassment and raise awareness about the problem. Nate Tabak's got the story from the capital, Pristina, and I should warn you, you may find some of the descriptions of harassment in Nate's story fairly graphic.
Rita Parashumti says street harassment can get very nasty in Pristina. The way someone stares at you and the things people say are really gross. Once I was walking down the street with my mother and an older guy said something really brutal to me, like, I wish I'm gonna eat your something. You know, it was like I felt really embarrassed in front of my mother.
Parashumti is a medical student in Kosovo, and she says this kind of thing happens all the time here. But nobody really talked about it publicly until Kosovo had its first Take Back the Night campaign in 2014. As part of that, Parashumti spent 8 hours walking around the streets of Pristina while being secretly filmed. The idea came from the viral video, 10 Hours of Walking in NYC as a Woman.
Relax, baby, be cool.
Hello.
Relax, baby, be cool.
Hello.
Relax, baby, be cool.
Over the course of the Kosovo video, Parashumti gets whistles, lewd comments. Two guys actually follow her for 8 minutes.
Actually, it was the first time that I was happy when someone said something because, you know, I thought, wow, we got this filmed.
The video got a lot of attention. People started talking about street harassment here.
When I saw how many people actually do want the change and are disgusted by this phenomenon, then I got more hope that something will change for better in a smaller amount of time.
And now, Parashumti may be getting her wish. Programmer Blerta Thachi remembers a time when she was the only woman in the room. But on this particular afternoon, she's supervising 30 women, all coders. They're developing a new app called Ets Shlir. It means walk freely in Albanian, and it's inspired by Hala Back, an American app for reporting street harassment. Women are notoriously underrepresented among the world's programmers. Kosovo has that problem, only worse. It's not just tech jobs. Only 1 in 10 women is employed. It's like Saudi Arabia in that regard. So Thachi started a women's coding group.
I wanted to make it a cool thing for girls as well. They thought that this is not something that they can do because it's only for boys or something like that. But it's the opposite.
These young programmers have a personal stake in making this app. They all have experience with harassment.
It's happening. It happens every day.
That's Kaltrina Morsili. She's 23.
It's not just happening, for example, one girl. It's happening to your sister, to your mother, to your daughter, to everybody.
Sexual harassment of any kind, let alone street harassment, is almost never reported here. The laws are vague, and enforcement is rare. Ets Shlir will allow users to report all types of sexual harassment, not just the street variety. And while it will include an emergency button to call police, that's not the primary goal. It's about making it possible for women to acknowledge and report harassment in a way that's easy and safe.
For girls, I would say if you love yourself, if you respect yourself, use it. It's useful for you. So you can easily raise your voice without making too much noise.
That real noise may come in the form of data from the app. The data will be used for public campaigns, and a website will show where the harassment is happening. Vyosa Pranichi, who's 24, says it may make men think twice about harassing.
And also women can learn from this because they should not support guys and say, oh, harassment, it's not thing, and it's a casual thing.
For the moment, though, chief programmer Blerta Thachi doesn't mind when guys harass her.
They are helping me, but it's just for the application will be online and then we will talk differently.
That will happen starting Thursday when the app launches. For The World, Nate Tabak, Pristina.
Before the break, I want to tell you about another one of my Tehran stories, which I'll have for you tomorrow. Whenever I travel, I like to check out the local food scene because you got to eat and you might as well eat well. During my time in Tehran, I had some great meals and I met a writer who says foodies across the globe should be setting their sights on some Iranian favorites.
Quince is one of them for sure, which one of my predictions is that quince is going to be the next breakout fruit, like probably surpassing pomegranate. Although turnip could make a showing there as well. I feel like turnip is very much is understated. And, it's big here. Oh, we do. Like we use it for its healing properties, but we also use it in soup.
That's Azita Hushyar, an Iranian-born Brooklyn-raised food blogger in Tehran. We'll talk Iranian cuisine with her tomorrow. On the menu, lamb stew, homemade bread, and something called abgusht. Oh, and a deconstructed watermelon sandwich. Seriously, be sure to join us. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. Someone on Twitter voiced his political leanings yesterday. I know, shocking. But this one caught our eye. It was sent out by Oscar Castillo, who was born in El Salvador. He's now a U.S. citizen, an entrepreneur living in Dallas, Texas. Castillo wrote, "After much thought, I've decided to vote for Marco Rubio. We wanted to find out why as part of our effort to introduce you to backers of various candidates in this year's presidential race."
I was born in the small country of El Salvador. Mom and dad came here as missionaries in the early 90s to start a Spanish-speaking church here in the Dallas area. And so been able to kind of grab and see that perspective of a struggling couple, which were my parents, and to see how they have now kind of come forth. And now I get the opportunity to be a part of this American experience.
So you're supporting Marco Rubio, as I said. He identifies as white, Cuban-American. That's a background that's very distinct from many Latinos in the U.S. How do you understand his identity?
You know, it's quite interesting because when I sit and chat with my friends, you know, within Latin America, when we talk about Latin America is not one nation. It's 20-plus nations. In the beginning, I have to admit, I was kind of hesitant, just the fact that he was Cuban. You know, sometimes we get into that within the Latino community, we don't want to let others go just because they're not from our own country and they may not understand us. But the more and more I started to hear him speak and do the background research, right, the put in the time to see where he came from and kind of hear his narrative and his story, I started to resonate. I started to identify with him. I do hear him talk about his parents, and I identify with that. You know, they were kind of a sacrificial lamb, if you will, to start this new generation here in the U.S.
As you know, Oscar, Senator Rubio's positions on immigration have been complex and sometimes contradictory. He backed the Senate's 2013 immigration reform bill, but now distances himself from that reform. And he's even said on CNN recently that he's ready to get rid of Obama's 2012 deferred action for childhood arrival. So do any of those positions give you pause?
Yes, they do. But I see where he's coming from, and I feel that he understands the state and the condition in which many Latino families find themselves today, right? Where we want to do good, and I can speak for a lot of Latinos that want to be legal, that want to do things within the law and not break any laws. But then at the same time, they see the needs in their families, and they want to see their families move forward. They want a better future. He is for seeing people thrive and seeing people better themselves.
I'm just curious, though, if you had some families in the Dallas area who are facing possible deportation, what would you say to them to convince them to vote for Rubio?
It's a very personal thing. I have not only family members, but also friends of mine. And within the work that I've done here in Dallas from a social standpoint, obviously, we know that the immigration system is somewhat broken. It's broken, actually. Let's not say just somewhat, but it is broken. And it needs a lot of reform. But I feel, as I've listened to Marco and I see he's more realistic, I see where people say that he's hardening his stance. I think there is also on the other side, and this is where I personally kind of have to balance myself out to understand that we've got to make a reform and there's got to be law. We can't break laws just because. So there's that balance we need to find. And I'm trusting that he will look out not only for the best interest of Latinos, because this shouldn't be a racial conversation. This should be very much a conversation that is very worldwide in our perspective and our role in this world as the United States of America.
Oscar Castillo speaking with me from Dallas, where he's an entrepreneur and recently decided he's going to vote for Marco Rubio. Oscar, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Finally today, let's head back to Brazil and rejoin our Across Women's Lives team. As you know, they're in Brazil this week, bringing us stories about women, water, and the environment. Hashtag Her Planet. One Brazilian artist covers all three bases. Her name is Nelly Acevedo. She's best known for big public art pieces. Acevedo creates hundreds of small human figures using ice and then puts the little sculptures in city squares all over the world where they quickly melt. Her installations have been adopted by some environmentalists as a kind of climate change art, but is it? What do Acevedo's melting ice people really mean? Our environmental reporter Carolyn Beeler spent some time with her to find out.
I met Nelly Acevedo at her combo apartment studio in a pretty fancy neighborhood in Sao Paulo.
Okay.
Hello, I'm Carolyn.
I am Nelly Acevedo.
So nice to meet you.
So,
Azevedo's in her 60s and wears stylish yellow and black rectangular glasses. She leads me inside, and I ask her about the inspiration for her art. It turns out Azevedo wasn't thinking about climate change at all when she started making art from ice in 2002. She was thinking about historical monuments, those bronze guys on rearing horses and generals on pedestals.
Peguei cada característica do monumento oficial e fiz ao contrário.
I took every characteristic of the official monuments and made the opposite, she says. I made small figures that sit on the ground. It doesn't honor anybody. It does honor the anonymous. Azevedo wanted her art to get people thinking about impermanence.
Eu busquei, fiquei buscando, pesquisando 2 anos.
She says she searched for 2 years for the material that would most poetically convey her message, and she landed on water. But Azevedo says she's fine with her art taking on a meaning of its own, especially an important issue like climate change. She's working on a new installation art project now, still with ice. I wanted to see it, so she opened a big chest freezer in her kitchen to show it to me. She took out these long, skinny, stretched-out human figures made of ice that were more than 3 feet long, and she carried them into her living room. There, she climbed up on a ladder and started to hang them from the ceiling. One breaks at the knees as she hangs it. The afternoon sun is streaming in, bouncing off the white walls, and the figures spin around lazily. They're kind of just hanging there. That is, until Azevedo puts metal bowls on the floor underneath each sculpture. As water melts off of them, the bowls amplify the sound of the drips. This tiny, watery orchestra makes not just Azevedo's art, but the artist herself come alive. When she shows this installation next fall, her plan is to use microphones to amplify the drips even more, so it sounds like this.
Principalmente em retomar a condição de mortal.
This is mainly to reinforce our mortality, she says, to remind ourselves that we all die. That's kind of depressing.
No, it's not depressing. Porque
Azevedo says if we're reminded that we all die eventually, we'll live better lives while we're still around. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Sao Paulo, Brazil.
Our Across Women's Lives stories continue tomorrow. You can check out hashtag Her Planet from Brazil online 24/7. We've posted a powerful photo essay, Portraits of Parents of Children Born with Microcephaly. That's at pri.org/herplanet. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.